Welcome to you, one and all. This is Soft Revolution, the podcast. I'm Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And we are back after a couple of weeks away, during which I once again drove across this country. For some insane reason, it feels safer than flying in a plane right now. And came east again, and we apologize for our absence, but we hope you've been okay in the time away. And we've got a great show for you today. Coming back to the pod is our dear friend, Chili Gonzalez, who wrote to us last week to say that he's a regular listener, which is thrilling to me because I think he's a brilliant guy, and that that he's got a ton of stuff that he disagrees with me about. So we're going to get Gonzo on to talk about all the reasons that I'm wrong about various things in the world. And really, that could be a podcast in itself, is just people I know.
A whole series. Coming,
yeah, just people I know saying why Campbell's wrong would be, you could right. do hundreds of episodes. So anyway, we've got him coming up later. That's really exciting for us. But first, Ali Moman of Toronto. How are you, my man? I haven't spoken to you in a while. How's life been, and what are you thinking about these days?
Long time, man. I want to say before we get into it, you know, we're going to do the talk with Chili, and we're going to subject him to the Proust questionnaire. And I want people to know that if you want to listen to the Proust questionnaire or the extended interview, get on the Patreon, patreon.com/softrevolution. It's there. Sign up, $3 a month. And you get access to, you know, all the goods, and you support us. And that's amazing.
What
am I thinking about? Yeah, please do that. Please do that. Well, I don't know. I'm actually thinking about you. I really want to know how your drive-in concert went. That's really what I've been really excited to ask you about.
Well, the drive is getting pretty surreal. Like when you start to know various gas stations in Northern Ontario as if they were places that you go to regularly. You really know life has changed. So, I mean, the drive was intense. It was 15 hours a day. As I've said before, this place is incredibly beautiful and incredibly empty. And it did, as I was driving, occur to me that for those of us in the art world, it's always been a struggle to speak to this whole country and to make art that reflects the huge variety of experiences and backgrounds and stories that constitute this country. And, you know, I think over the past 20 or 30 years, we started to stitch together maybe something that might have resembled the kind of national cultural scene that you have in European countries or in the States, other places that are smaller and have more people in them. But I think we've taken a big blow. And as I drove past Calgary and Winnipeg and all those cities that had vibrant theater scenes and art scenes happening in them, my heart felt sad at the thought of how hard it's going to be for all those folks who have been earning a living there and living there and investing in their communities. You know, I have a lot of admiration for artists who don't migrate to the big cities, you know, who don't go to LA or New York or Toronto or London, but actually have the strength and have the kind of optimism to stay in their hometowns and make professional art there and make world-class art. And some of the best stuff around has come out of the smaller communities in this country. You know, I think of somewhere like the Manitoba Theater Center, or I think of Theatre Calgary, are places that really grew into major employers in the city from nothing, you know? And those places are going to face an incredibly steep hill. And I just really hope that the communities that they are in take a minute to recognize in the process of recognizing all kinds of things and trying to bring back all kinds of things to life when this shit is over, remember that so much of their downtown core, so much of their nightlife, so much of the things that made them a vibrant city right now are about the cultural workers that decided to stay there and invest their time and their energy and their love into the places they come from. So, and then I got to Prince Edward County, which is where we played the Golden Hour Festival. White Horse played, the Sadies played, we played, Dizzy played. It was a bunch of great bands, and it was organized by a fantastic group of young women, all of whom, you know, had work just disappear on them. They're all people who work in events and music festivals, et cetera. And all of their work disappeared. And instead of lying down and giving up, they got together as friends and created this fantastic little festival in a drive-in movie theater in Prince Edward County. For some reason, which I would love one day an answer to, you can't stand outside your car in a massive field on a windy day in Prince Edward County, but you can go into a bar and scream in each other's faces over a hockey game in Ontario.
Hold on. You can't stand outside your car.
You couldn't get out of your car. You have to stay in the car.
Wow. Is like, there a limit? So I wanted to ask you, you know, we have the 100, you know, in Ontario, we have a 100 person outdoor gathering. Does that apply to people in their cars?
I guess not.
No?
And that's why they had to
you
stay
had more
in their
than,
car.
That's why.
There was literally 20 to 30 feet of space between each car. They didn't cram cars in. It was pretty full, but there was no danger whatsoever of a spreading event. On this day, in this field, the way people were arranged.
Of course not.
They had taken every single precaution, and still the government tells us no. And if you run the Brass Rail Strip Club, please cram them in there. And it's just like, you know, for a while it was like, okay, well, we're all adjusting to this. We're all trying to figure out what this virus is.
Yeah, in the beginning, totally, yes.
Yeah, but fuck this, man. And fuck these governments and fuck the corporate structure for just abandoning art at this moment. You know, I hope that artists don't forget this. I hope that when people come back and pretend that they were there for us, namely philanthropists, rich people who like having their names on buildings, people who pretend that they give a shit because they can go to opening nights and wear their fancy tuxedos, when the theaters are back, I don't want them to welcome those kind of people. Those people are riffraff. Those people are pimps and they used us. And if we're going to come back and do this thing again, no more of that. What this has really revealed to me, man, is the absolute moral and literal impossibility of the not-for-profit structure. We cannot be beholden to people who abandon us as soon as they see their 401ks go down. That is not our audience. Our audience is human beings who have a small amount of money to spend trying to achieve some kind of joy in their lives between 8 p.m. and 11 p.m. at night. And I swear to God, man, I'm done with that stuff. For me personally, when I come back, there won't be any more handshakes or applications to councils or begging for money from rich people. I'm done. I don't care. Stay away from me.
You're going to the people.
I'm going to the people or I'm not going anywhere. You know, I'm going to Patreon. Right. I'm going to direct marketing to my audience or I'm not going to do it. And so really it's up to the audience, whether you are a music fan or a theater fan or whatever you are, you've got to decide that investing some of your money in art is as important to you as putting away money in an RRSP or saving for your kids' education or trying to do a house reno or anything that you decide is important to you. And if you don't do that, there won't be any art. There just won't be. And people think that's hyperbolic. Just wait and see. So we did the gig and it was, you know, the spirit of it was beautiful. I really admired these young people who organized it. They did it incredibly efficiently. It felt really safe. You know, the rock festivals are all outside. People are in tents. In retrospect, I think it's going to be tough for people to look back and say, why did we respond with complete closure? Did lockdown get us anywhere? I'm starting to feel like maybe it just didn't. And that...
We could address that. We could talk about
that. Yeah, well, so we did the show. And it was hard. It was hard. You know, people beeped their horns afterwards and people flashed their lights. And there was a human spirit there that wanted to be back to something resembling happiness. But in a way, it just accentuated what we've lost. I have to be honest with you. I wouldn't want to do it again. And I don't think it's the future. And I don't think it's the new normal. And more and more and more, I'm so sick of this fucking phrase, the new normal. It's not normal. So there's no point in saying it's the new normal. It's not normal. Right. Normal is an objective standard. Normal is human beings being able to interact with each other. That is, sorry guys, that's been 500,000 years of evolution. So we're going to call it normal. I refuse to accept that sitting in my house with a glowing box, pretending I'm living, is ever going to be the new normal. So, yeah, it's not going to work. You know, the Zoom shows, the shows in cars, all these things that we thought maybe would take us into a new era. I'm totally unconvinced. I'm totally uninterested. And I am redoubling my energy and focus on the idea of how do we get back some semblance of what we had and how do we get back all of it eventually. That's the only way.
Yeah, I think that's the way to kind of think about it. These cases are rising in Ontario.
And everywhere.
And they're coming, you know, everywhere, really. And I keep thinking to myself, it's like, look, people obviously want to get together. People obviously want to interact. Humans want a human. I do want to say one thing. Obviously, you know, the cases are predominantly towards younger people. You know, 67% of the cases in Ontario are for people who are under 40. And that creates a kind of idea that, oh, it's just, you know, a bunch of young people just going out and partying and whatever. But when you go to the mall, I want you to ask yourself, what does the employee at that store look like? What is their age? When you go to the restaurant, ask yourself what that employee at the store looks like. What is their age? When you are doing all those things, when you leave your laptop, making your six figures on your computer, just sending email back and forth, not to disparage what people do, but you know what I mean? Ask yourself the people who are out there, what is their demographic? What is their age? So I just want to, you know, speak on the behalf of my generation. Yeah. And say that it isn't just partying, okay? However, what I will say in respect to what you're talking about is that at this point now, 6 months gone, it's going to be really interesting talking to Chili because he's in Germany and it seems like they've had a little bit more creative thinking.
Just played a gig to 1,000 people.
1,000 people. I talk about the Restart 19 Germany, baby.
Yeah.
So here, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me that 50 people inside a bar, 50 people inside a restaurant is not equivalent to a theater that can fit 1,200 people, that has assigned seating, that can enforce masking, that can limit or basically deny food and drink. It just doesn't make sense to me anymore. And unfortunately, nothing is going to change.
No,
I really, and particularly in Canada, and I think in America as well too, because in America, I was just reading the New York Times today, you know, and the headline of the article is that movie theaters returned, audiences didn't. Now what? People are not going to movie theaters. Tenet was a disappointment. They're pushing forward Wonder Woman 2, Black Widow, Marvel's Black Widow is now being pushed forward. It's whack. Did you hear Fauci talk to Jennifer Garner? Fauci talked to Jennifer Garner. She's
I didn't. What was the gist of that?
He was on her Instagram live and she was like, hey, you know, when can people go back to theaters? And she was referring to movie theaters and theaters, plays and stuff like that and musicals. And he was like, you know, it's going to take, the vaccine comes and then a year after the vaccine. So, you know, to go back to that place where people can just like be filling up a theater, you're looking at a year after a vaccine.
Okay.
And I said, okay, you're an epidemiologist. I understand. But doesn't mean that I don't want to accept that answer.
Do you know what's incredible to me is that these conversations are had, that these medical experts come on and I swear to God, I sometimes feel like I'm tripping on acid or something. Like nobody in the media and nobody who is talking ever refers to the consequences of this stuff for a huge sector of the economy. Like, am I losing my mind or something?
Wait. They do it for restaurants. They do it for restaurants and bars. They really do.
They
see it, you know, Doug Ford, our premier. Not for us.
Like, let's take Yonge Street just for an example. there are what, five,
Yonge Street is the largest city in Toronto.
Yeah, largest street in the largest city. So there are what, five, six, seven large theaters doing commercial productions of shows there. That is millions of dollars a week, Doug, going into the economy. Hey, Bonnie Henry, like, your entire fucking city is predicated on people coming there, going to Bard on the Beach, going to the fireworks, going to see outdoor concerts, going to festivals. Do you give a shit? Do you have a plan? I'm sorry if I'm sounding strident and hysterical, but fuck, man, I was patient. What the fuck is going on? Like, has there been some kind of pact agreed upon where, like, art is just going to be left? Like, they're like, well, we got to sacrifice something, so we'll just sacrifice culture. I think they literally might have had that conversation. Because here's
the truth. Have you heard of Hanlon's Razor?
Well, no. All this to say, like, I have heard from reliable sources that the government of Canada is, they're done. There's no more money for the arts. That $500 million is it. They're going to start investing in something resembling a long-term guaranteed income. But in terms of actually supporting direct art, quite apart from our idea of the Arts New Deal, they don't want to give a single fucking penny to the arts. That's the plan, in case you're wondering. So if you're still, you know, sitting around praising these people for their response and you're an artist, stop being a sheep. These people have fucking betrayed us and let us down. And I'm talking about Justin Trudeau and Stéphane Guibeau and all the people who made nice noises at the beginning of this. We'll never let you down. We'll never leave you alone. We'll never let your business close because of COVID-19. We didn't make this choice. We didn't say, hey, we're going to voluntarily close down. We were forced to do this. And now you have no plan, no fucking plan, and no care. So I'm done with the politicians as well. Like, it's been a couple of weeks of just kind of resigning myself that, all the people I thought were shitty really are shitty, and we can only rely on each other. So please tell me about Hanlon's Razor and make it something cheerful. For the love of God.
I'm just gonna say that, like, you know, do not attribute to malice that which could be attributed to incompetence.
Yeah,
and there's just a lot of incompetence. I really don't think these are evil people. However, when in Vancouver, when obviously bars and restaurants were a driver of transmission, Bonnie Henry didn't say, we're shutting it down. She said, we're going to limit it till 10 p.m. Here in Toronto, they want to limit it to 12. In New Jersey, they're saying indoor dining at 25%. They say, we're going to limit the music because when music is too loud, people talk loudly. Makes sense. 100%. They never said, we're shutting it down because for some reason, and I don't disagree. I don't want to be like, fuck restaurants, fuck bars. But for some reason, going to a restaurant and going to a bar has this kind of, like, I don't know, angelic thing to politicians. I guess because it's so kind of like of the earth, but you know what? So is culture. Culture is of the earth. Art is of the earth. You know, your soul is of the fucking earth. You carry it with you all the time. So it's about telling our politicians and making sure society recognizes that, like, yeah, you know, a bar closing down, a restaurant closing down, that's a small business, but also a theater is a small business. You know, Mirvish isn't like this huge, crazy conglomerate, okay? It, at the end of the day, it is a family kind of run business that employs a lot of people. It isn't, you know, it
this is Mirvish
Tesla.
Productions,
it isn't
by
Apple.
The way.
Mirvish it's Productions, yeah, which is like our largest commercial production.
Yeah.
So that's really what it is. So we need to have, rather than saying you can't do theater, you can only have 50 people, you can't do concert, you can only have 50 people. Can we do a little bit more, you know, something like Germany? But that's what's going to be so cool about talking to Chile, because I think even I look at Germany and I go, wow, utopia. So it's going to be interesting to hear what Chile thinks.
Well, so let's quickly talk about something that is really the big news that I have right now. I have been snooping around doing a little fake journalism, which is apparently, according to Donald Trump, the only kind of journalism there is. I've been looking for some fake news and I found some real news. And now this is kind of news that's out there, but this is the story I have. I have a source that has in the in recent days been privy to a test in which he pricked his finger, put a drop of blood onto a sheet of paper, and in 15 minutes with 99.7% accuracy, he was told whether he had COVID or had ever had COVID. There is a guy in Canada, a rich guy, who has bought a bunch of these from the UK. This is why Boris Johnson has been going around saying that Christmas will be relatively normal, because he is going all in on these tests. And for some reason, the media are not writing about these tests. Health Canada, I have it upon good authority, is very wary of the presence of these tests because they fear that it will create a two-tiered society. I'm not sure why or how that works, but that's something we can talk about. But it's $20. And there are 15 companies working on different kinds of tests and scaling it down to as low as $5. So if these, what this rich guy said to my source is, if you are running a cultural organization right now, or if you are an artist and making plans for next year and your plans are, it's a write-off, think again, because these things are about to be everywhere. And it will raise ethical issues and it will raise practical issues, but it also could fundamentally and profoundly change the nature of the next year for artists. Because if you can add $10 to a ticket and someone can take a test in 10 minutes outside the door of your establishment and then show you that test, some of them are spit tests. Some of them don't even require blood. We're talking about a completely different level of possibilities in terms of how many people you can get into a space and where you can make art. So,
yeah, the logistics are going to be tough. Logistics of it are tough. But yeah, you know what? Until, listen, a vaccine, full disclosure, Ali Momin has invested in some vaccine companies. So I've read a lot about messenger RNA and all that stuff. Anyways, so I will tell you, you know, under the best circumstance, we're not going to be, Fauci is right that it is going to take a year before the vaccine is introduced, even if it's a Trumpian October surprise. It's still going to take a year after that before it gets around. So testing really is our way out. And it was a Dr. Tam yesterday spoke about how she wants to have Health Canada approve a rapid antigen test. The thing is right now, I think these tests that you're referring to, they're like you buy them privately and they're not really, you know, whatever. So one, we have to, like, testing really is our way out because it makes a lot of sense. You test rapidly, it's easy. You know, and if you know you have it, you quickly isolate, you trace your contacts. Like, this is a really great way to fight this this virus. I do want to say one final thing before we go to Chile, something I've been thinking about large. This is a shit show. This is a really fucking terrible situation, particularly for those of us in the arts. However, I do want to say something about us as human beings. Spanish flu took millions, 50 to 100 million people. The bubonic plague took 35 to like 70 million people, right? Whenever these plagues have come, human beings, just because maybe of what we were capable of or who we were as a society and as humans, we ultimately just chose death. We ultimately chose for it to ride through. And this has not been perfect, and this has been devastating for us. But I think in hindsight, we will look back and we will say that we chose life over death, and that's something that we should be grateful for. With that being said, we are the most creative species that has ever walked this planet. And it's important for us to not think either or, but to think and. How do we maintain life and thrive at the same time? That's what I hope now we strive for.
Yeah. And I think that's beautifully optimistic.
That's my hope.
And I think that's true, Ali. I think there has been, in many ways, we haven't given all of us ourselves enough credit for the act of imagination that we have embarked on in terms of this disease, because for the vast majority of us, the disease might be a nasty week or two. But for a small minority of us, it kills us or ruins our lives. And society has decided that matters. And that's a step.
And that's novel.
That's novel because we've decided that, for example, opiate addicts don't matter. And we've decided that indigenous people in the North, indigenous children don't matter. And we've decided for hundreds of years that Black lives don't matter. So let's hope that this active imagination can ripple out and we can start finding some other pandemics in our society to get united about. The pandemic of racism, the pandemic of what capitalism has done to people's lives, the pandemic of systemic and brutal excision of other cultures and other people's traditions and other people's needs and all that stuff. Because this is what, to me, this virus and capitalism, they go together. There's no separating those two things. If we were not living in a system that ruthlessly put money above everything, then getting rid of this virus when it first appeared would have been infinitely simpler. So let's not kid ourselves. Capitalism won't get us out of it, and capitalism put us in it. And the only way forward, whether it's these fires that are making, you know, the day that where I am in North Hadley, Quebec, smoky right now, or whether it's COVID-19, whatever it is, we got to do it without these devils running the show, you know?
I feel you.
That's my hope too. So let's get to Chili Gonzalez, because
boom,
I want to know all the reasons that I'm wrong. The musical genius, Chili Gonzalez, live and direct from Cologne, West Germany. Gonzo, how are you? Welcome back to Soft Revolution.
Thank you. Am I your first returning guest?
I wish we could say that was true, Gonzo, but you're not. Actually, Jennifer Lena, who is a fantastic thinker and academic and writer in the States, has joined us for two shows, but you are now our second only returning guest. So if you do this again, for some reason, should you find yourself so bored that you want to be on this podcast again, you would then hold the record. And I know you love holding records. I know that's a big thing for you.
Do you know why I'm back? I mean, I wrote you, Torque, like last time.
You did.
Because I start to feel very strongly when I hear you go on some of your rants. And I have this urge to push back on some of the things you're saying sometimes.
I like the phrase strongly. That's a nice way of saying I want to reach through my computer and murder you. Okay, so let's get to it. Why am I so wrong, Gonzo? And what makes you so right? What was it that drove you crazy? Let's get to it.
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that I played a gig a couple of weeks ago here in Cologne.
Okay, yes. Give us a rundown on that.
I played for about 1,000 people outdoors in a kind of protocol that was very strange. So they had rows of 10 seats, and between those rows, there was distancing. But within the actual rows of 10, everyone was sitting next to each other with no space in between. And that meant that
they were strangers.
You could conceivably be sat next to a stranger, which I thought was risky and surprising. Those are the rules in the German state I live in, North Rhine-Westphalia. And the idea behind it was that these are considered pods of 10. There was very heavy, of course, tracing and registration, and people had to fill out forms online before even coming. And the idea was that if someone would be sick in your group of 10, they would only have to really notify and aggressively trace those 10 people. And that seemed like a doable risk for the 1,000 people that showed up. And what I thought was so interesting was that there are 1,000 people willing to take that risk, but also that is a much lower number than I would normally play to in my hometown of Cologne. Now, I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, because if I come to play anywhere in North America, that'll be like 200 people, basically. But anyway, it just so happens in Cologne, where I live, that I'm usually able to play 2 or 3 nights in a 2,000-seat classical hall here once a year, and it'll be sold out. So obviously, there's a kind of rump of people who are willing to take a risk to see the performing arts. And that's what kind of got me thinking about your rant and your insistence of the importance of the performing arts. And it sort of made me think, well, maybe we're just not that important. Maybe for a very small, you know, sort of subgroup of people, it's really so in their habits, so in their definition of themselves to be consumers of live performance, that they will take that risk and possibly sit next to a stranger, possibly get sick in order to watch a concert or a play or something else. But that maybe we're much less important than we think. And that, you know, the arts are everywhere. They're online, they're in books. There's hundreds of years of art that we still have to explore. Most of my listening habits and viewing habits are things that aren't new. And it really got me thinking that perhaps this is the way it is. Whether it should be that way or not, it kind of opened my eyes to, well, there's only 1,000 people who really, really want it. The rest are just fair weather friends, curiosity seekers, people who are looking for something to do, but that art isn't maybe that vital for that many people. And maybe it's a good thing for us to say that. You know, there's so many COVID-themed interviews, especially in Europe, and it's very dramatic the way people are like, more than ever, art is the one thing we need to heal. And it's like, no, we need information and medicine and money and so many more things on the list before art that happens live in a room together. Like, that's okay. Way, way, way down the list.
So I think it's in a miraculous turn of events, we can both be right. Because I think it turns out you're probably right. We weren't as important to a vast majority of our audience as we maybe thought we were. And I was just talking to Ali before this on another rant that will annoy you, saying, maybe this one won't annoy you because it goes back to our original conversation, which is like, to me, this whole thing has revealed the absolute just total catastrophe of the not-for-profit model in the arts, in the culture sector, because we were beholden to masters that abandoned us at the first sign of trouble, whether it was corporate masters or whether it was philanthropic masters or whether it was government grant masters. None of them came through in Canada.
Wait,
anyway.
Torkel, did you listen to Kanye's tweets? Because he was tweeting about this
night. I don't listen to Kanye's tweets.
Well, no, but he was on a tweet storm talking about how he wants to completely change and dismantle all the music contracts that existed prior because it's about slave and masters. And he was using this master metaphor. So I encourage, that's pretty crazy. Anyways, go on.
Well, it's me and Kanye, we're intellectual equals. And that's the worst thing I can possibly say for myself. But I think that what this has revealed is that without that propping up, these institutions don't have an audience that is particularly loyal to them. But Gons, that's not a good thing. As you said, you mentioned this may or may not be a good thing. It's a terrible thing. And it's sort of like saying, well, it turns out that people can live without hugs. That hugging wasn't as important as we all thought it was. Here we all are 6 months later and we haven't hugged each other in months, so who cares? Maybe it wasn't important that we hugged. Yeah, it fucking was important that we hugged because it made life more beautiful and it reaffirmed what it meant to be human. And I would argue that the performing arts, once they left the church 2,000 years ago and went out into the street and started making punters pay for it and gathering people in rooms, it allowed people a form of secular religious experience that held their hearts together, held communities together, and gave people a sense of beauty. And, you know, yes, I am a person who has a ridiculous life philosophy, which is that beauty matters. But that's my philosophy. So my rant came out of, my own personal sense that, yeah, I think you're 100% correct. I feel betrayed because I feel like people don't really give a shit and that I've been living this life sort of, I kind of knew that people cared less and less about live art. You only have to look at the ticket sales to know that, right? Everybody's ticket sales are down. U2's ticket sales are down. So we know that people are slowly but surely being won over to digital existence, but that don't make it right. Does it?
It doesn't make it right. I don't know that live performances, no matter how good or bad they might be, rise to the level of a hug.
I can't believe you're saying that. You have given performances in front of me that have changed my fucking life, man. That have made me cry, that have made me think about working harder, that have given me unforgettable nights. So I feel like that is a concession to a loss of something that is basically human inside of us that we just can't concede. We can't give in to that.
But you're an artist as well. So you understand the connection. You understand that church-like sort of connection that many people, sadly, I will admit, but it's something we maybe have to accept, do not make that connection anymore. For them, live performance is not the hug. For them, live performance is not the church. It's just something that they go and do sometimes because it's out there. And when there wasn't a risk of getting sick, it seemed like a fun thing to do. But it could easily be replaced for them by reading a book, watching Netflix. And in some cases, you know, I've been reading a lot of novels. And sure, that's not a communal experience, but that's been a really positive effect of the changes that happened in March is that, you know, I'm reading 150 pages a day of literature and all kinds of wonderful things that are really life-changing for me. And I sort of see that as a positive. I found a way to replace what I would have maybe been looking for somewhere else. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing for someone like you or me, who as an artist has a voracious appetite for consuming other art and is actively looking to be inspired. But we're a very, very small minority.
Chili, I think what you're talking about very much is like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, it's that physiological safety, love, esteem, and then finally self-actualization. Torkel, what you were describing, going to see a concert, a Chili Gonzalez concert, and what that made you feel, that's at the top of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. That comes at the end. That's what you strive for. But you can't get there until you have the other bits of the triangle first. So I think, you know, okay, Chili, it seems like what you're saying.
Not to mention, just very quickly, that within the self-actualization world, there are many ways to get that. And live performance is yet a thinner slice of that.
Let's say I give you that point, okay? Even if that's true, okay? Even if the experience of live performance can be replaced with consumption of art in different ways, which I reject, but I accept that some people may find that to be true for themselves. There are tons of industries that are subsidized. There are tons of industries that are carried on in society the amount of money or the amount of importance they have in society is not reflected by the amount of money invested in them. Farming is subsidized to the hilt. There are farmers all across Saskatchewan who make more wheat than they can sell and can't make a profit. And so the government subsidizes their wheat sales in order to keep farming going, because farming has been agreed upon to be something that is essential to society. So I can't accept a society in which we have said, you know, education's essential. We're going to subsidize education. Food is essential. We're going to subsidize food. Travel is essential. We're going to subsidize travel. We're going to subsidize Air Canada to the hilt. We're going to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for public projects to make sure that private companies can run their trucks down the road. But art? No, art's not essential. The human soul, the story of our common existence, language, human emotion, those things aren't essential. We're not going to subsidize them because, look, we've left them to lie on their own and nobody cares. I mean,
didn't the Canada Council just double their budget and make all these reforms in the last like couple of months?
Well, now you're stepping into a whole other world. Okay.
I just listened to the Jesse Brown Canada Land conversation.
The Canada Council just doubled its budget, but also did a number of things which will make it more of an advocacy organization than it is a public funding organization. And we can, that's a huge conversation about whether that's the right move or the wrong move. But certainly the Canada Council is not going to be in the next 5 years saving Canadian culture. It's going to be focused on reconciliation with Indigenous people.
You will admit that by doubling its budget in a year where artists need it more than ever.
I support that. I'm in support of that.
You could understand why I would say that in the face of your extremist rant saying you've been left behind and betrayed.
We have been left behind and betrayed. We've been left behind and betrayed by the lack of imagination and the lack of... See, you're talking from Germany. And this is, I also think, even though you're a Canadian, I do... what I'm picking up in what you're saying is a kind of confidence, a certainty that comes with living in a society where art really is thought of as important. And so... You know, you come, I've toured Germany many, many times. You've lived there for many, many years. And we both know that from A to Z, from a 9-year-old child to an 80-year-old woman, everybody in between has a deeper understanding of the place of culture in their lives than people here do. And so
I will give you that. And it's possible that by not being in Canada, I'm just not aware of just how sort of, you know, dark it has become in a way.
I mean, there's abandonment and then there's abandonment. And I think that what we're seeing in North America right now is not just an abandonment of the cultural community, but an actual sort of willful, ignorance of the possibilities of what these rules are doing to the future of culture. We're very seriously looking at, you know, 5 years from now in Canada, there being no theaters left. That is not crazy to say. Whereas in Germany, they simply wouldn't let that happen. They will subsidize it. And even for that small minority of people who care, they will say, okay, well, a small minority of people care, but we think that a healthy society includes culture. And I don't think that that's a given anymore in North America. I think you'd find lots of smart people like Elon Musk, for example, who would say, no, culture doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter whether you have an art gallery or a theater or a concert hall or even a local bar that has live music. Because if people don't want it, the market will dictate what people want, and then you have to listen to the market. That's not a world I want to live in.
No, I'll agree with you there. And, you know, I think the connection with education that you guys have made talking about your New Deal for the Arts, where you say, let's put the artists to work in other ways. It's not like you're asking to necessarily, hey, give me money so I can go on tour again. You're also just saying, hey, put me, you know, make me useful. And this, I think, is a really positive attitude that could break through and appeal to people in a way that, you know, there is this feeling, whether true or not, and I think there's probably more truth to it than you do, that to be an artist who essentially, you know, is able to live even in a small way from what you do, I think it is a real luxury compared to what other people's lives are like. I don't necessarily think that being an artist is hard once you've broken through to a first level of self-sufficiency. Now, I think it's very hard to get to that first level of self-sufficiency, but we're three people who all have or at least had that. And the idea of sort of comparing that to all other forms of labor, I can't quite do it, you know? And so I think the idea of saying we want to be useful, and like I said, part of that is a projection of society as well onto artists, that our lives must be easy and that we're trying to get away with something by having a life in which we create. I do understand that. And I'm, you know, just as much as you guys are, I'm constantly having to justify the fact that I've chosen this life in the eyes of many people. But your artistic New Deal really sort of breaks through that. And I think that would also could be tied in with the way that they fund the arts. Imagine if your Canada Council grant was tied to the idea of putting in a certain amount of service for artistic education, which will do what? It will, in theory, make people's taste, you know, more refined or at least more educated, and get us closer to what you sort of think Germany is like. That's one thing that could really work, is to sort of take on the chin. Okay, you think we're sort of self-absorbed, living this life of luxury. Okay, we'll kind of give you that. We're going to now sort of be an army of artists that are going to, you know, educate younger people and thus create a new generation where you actually break the cycle once and for all.
I think that's a fantastic idea, but I have to push back against your suggestion that even in the first level of artistic achievement, our labor is somehow, our lifestyle is easier than other people's. You know, they did a massive survey of Canadian artists when the CERB happened, when the $2,000 a month government payment happened. They did a massive survey of Canadian artists, and over 70% of them said that $2,000 a month represented the most financial stability they had ever had in their careers. And these are professionals. These are people who are members of unions, so-called unions. Also, artists have no pension included in their work. We have no health care. We have no protection. We pay more taxes on average than anyone else. There's more depression. There's more mental health problems. There's more homelessness.
Yeah, but you get to sleep in.
Yes, you do get to sleep in. And I understand what you're saying, Gons, but I also think like this is, and this is something that I think is so fascinating, is that the myth of the artist as louche, as flaneur, as a kind of free-floating, work-shirking libertine that so many people in society have is so prevalent and has been around so long, and people have put so much energy into it that even artists believe it about themselves. And I have,
I'll consider that I might have internalized that myth a little bit. It's possible.
I mean, I grew up in a house where I was raised by a guy who got into the theater because he had been a conscientious objector in the Second World War and was an able-bodied male who had a trucker's license. So he got hired by a theater company to drive trucks. And 3 years later, he was playing Othello at the Old Vic in the West End of London. Now, he was a guy who worked 9 hours a day in the theater until he was 85 years old. He couldn't retire. There was no pension for him. There was the government pension he got from Canada.
But this is the point. He loved doing the theater, presumably.
He fucking hated it. About 70% of the time, it was pure, unadulterated misery. He was in terrible shows. He thought the director was a fool, or his knees hurt, or he couldn't remember the lines, or he'd been doing 8 shows a week for 7 months, and his body and his soul were worn out dry. Was he doing
what he loved? Would he answer yes?
I think my father would have said that what he loved was the people that he did it with. And that I think that he perceived his work as an artist in much the same way that anyone who enjoys their work does. If you work in a shop or you work in a warehouse and you work with people that you care about, and people who are good to you, and you have a laugh, and you have a great Christmas party, and people take care of each other, I think you have job satisfaction. And if you don't, you can be, you know, the lead dancer at the New York City Ballet and be getting sexually harassed by the artistic director every day of your fucking life and have your career end at 28. I just don't think that being an artist is easy. I'll admit it, a
large reason of why I got into music and performing specifically was for, you know, lightly psychopathic reasons.
A little light psychopathy,
a little side of psychopathy with your breakfast. Yeah, it was to, you know, it was to look for love in all the wrong places, to prove my existence, to create a feedback loop where I could act differently and have people reward me for it. And most specifically, and this is a very basic thing perhaps that makes me, you know, a man child who never grew up, so that no one will be telling me what to do. And I suppose when you talk about your dad, you know, both his jobs, people were essentially telling him what to do. That might be the difference in what you do and, you know, and what Ali does, because Ali as an actor has to exist a little bit more in a structure with a hierarchy, whereas we as sort of these self-contained, you know, in your case, of course, you have a band and it's a bit more democratic. In my case, I'm just an autocrat with an audience of one, you know, and that's me. And that's how I wanted it. And that's perhaps why I've internalized in some way this feeling that I'm lucky and that my life is easier than someone who has someone telling them what to do. That could be a small distinction.
I will grant you, success in rock and roll, in music, is a hell of a good lifestyle. And yes, that's true. But I think your point is important about the differences between the forms of art and success in those forms of art. You know, the theater is a very everyday thing. Ali was doing 8 shows a week, whether he liked it or not, for 3 years. And yeah, he was making great money and it was a hit show, but that's hard graft. So it's not the same as the life that you and I have been lucky enough to lead over the last 2 decades of, you know, touring when we want to tour and playing when we want to play and making records when we want to make them. But I also would say that the list of things that you gave about why you got into music in the first place are probably exactly the same list as somebody who went to law school or medical school or any other kind of pursuit that allows
finance.
Finance that they, you know, they wanted to easy money and beautiful ladies and whatever. Those things are aspirations that lead people into all kinds of work. And so I have become aware that on this podcast, I may be coming off as a kind of arts hysteric, that I am a person who is, you know, sounding the alarm in this way about the death of art during COVID-19 and ignoring how important all the other things are that are going on. I guess I'm willing to sound that way because I don't feel like anyone else is doing it. So if we aren't as artists going to call upon our own sense of importance right now, we're doomed. Like, I do think I agree with you. There is a huge risk of getting into a kind of, you know, like that fucking, all those celebrities singing Imagine, getting into that world of like, I have come down from the angels to remind you that it's very important you go to the theater. My point is, life is a mess. Society is a big, messy goop of lots of things, some of which some people love and some people hate. Everybody, you know, there's monster truck rallies and there's art exhibits and everything in between. And we've all agreed to live together and tolerate each other's weirdnesses and even support them because we like the feeling of living in a world where people's lives are being fulfilled and where people have a quality of life. People with good quality of life make better neighbors, better voters, better citizens, right? So even if there is just a small group of people even if there is just 1,000 people in Cologne who want to go see Gonzo in the middle of a pandemic, that's an important 1,000 people because they are members of our community. And I don't think that art should be ignored in the same way that I don't think all kinds of things that only affect small groups of people should be ignored.
Oh, I mean, don't get me wrong. Do you know how it felt amazing? Because first of all, they went really nuts. It was, and because
well,
of this—
Well, of course they did.
You know, and because of the fact that people weren't physically separated, of course there was a feeling of togetherness, even from the vantage point of the stage. The distance between the rows themselves was not that visible because of just how it looks. And so it looked and felt like a regular old concert to me in a really great way. And of course, we all have our role to play. I guess I only take issue with, as you say, the overplaying the hand of, you know, hey, look over here, I'm important, don't forget about me, which is such a big thing online and social media. I mean, the joke is yes. that you can see an article in any, you know, European newspaper, you'll see a giant reportage about why sex work is the new frontline in the COVID debate. And it's all about whether the brothels can open. And you have these sex workers coming out and saying, like, now more than ever, this is the most important thing. It's like, well, everything can't be the most important thing. We need some hierarchy. And as you say, the hierarchy of needs, or what was it again, Ali?
So Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah. You know, and I think it's good to keep that in mind. It's just also, despite the high that I was feeling after that concert and, you know, and on stage, just spontaneously blurting out, you know, music is back, motherfuckers, and everyone just screaming. despite that, I think it's still important to keep in mind where we fit in that hierarchy. We are, as performing artists, we are a small slice of the fifth need. And I just think it doesn't hurt to remind ourselves of that. And that will help us come up with ideas like the Artistic New Deal, which are humble offerings to society to be more relevant and will break the logjam of the problems that were there even before COVID.
And Torkel, I just want to say something that I've heard from you is, you know, in the same way, and even myself, and I don't know, Chili, if you feel the same way, if you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs from the audience, that's one way to look at it. But also if you look at it from us, like, you know, you mentioned that poll that came out and when Miranda Mulholland came on the show and she was talking about how so many musicians are just not feeling inspired to make, you know, to not feeling inspired to quote unquote in Maslow's way, self-actualize. It's because their physiological needs were not met. Their safety needs were not met. Their belongingness and love needs were not met first. All of us are in this place where these kind of three or the two really important ones at the bottom are not met. And that affects both the audience and it also affects the artist. For me, it's like, I don't know how you felt, Chili, but like to just do stuff for free and to just make it happen and to just do that, that doesn't really work anymore. So I think we're all kind of living in this place where we don't have our first two or three parts of that triangle met. We're in a pandemic.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's a really good point is if you are feeling really alienated and financially precarious, that is going to create a, you know, either a low level or a medium or maybe a high level of constant anxiety that might mean that you just can't even get to where you need to create. I think that's a really, really good point as well.
It goes back to something we talked about a few weeks ago. I don't know if you heard this episode, Gonzo, but I was saying I was talking to my wife, Moya, who's an actor and a director, and she was saying, she just said this thing to me, and I don't know why it struck me so hard, but she said, I think you have to really think about right now about what people need from us. And I think that opens a door, because I think, okay, let's say that we are down the scale or up the scale, however the Maslow's hierarchy of needs works, but we're along the line after physiological needs and after, you know, a job and all those things that people need to survive, shelter, a hug. But people, the purpose of art, if I can be so bold, one of the things art does is remind people what matters in life. It reminds people of those other four stages. And so empathy and imagination are essential for societies to work. If we can't imagine what other people are if we can't imagine what other people are experiencing and we can't understand what other people are experiencing, then we don't care about what they're experiencing. And so I think that art where you mentioned the word humble, I think you're right. Art has to be humble right now, and it has to go in search of its audience and maybe leave the concert halls and leave the cultural institutions behind for the time being and not expect thousands to cram into a hall, but actually go to them in whatever way we can, with stories, with music, hit the streets, go into courtyards or go into people's houses and do shows the way they did during the plague of the 16th century, right? The reason Shakespeare used to go into people's houses and do plays was because the theaters were closed. and he could only do plays in private homes. So
yes, of course, in terms of creating community, that is of course a much loftier goal. But the idea that, you know, art can show people what's important is a very February 2020 attitude in my book, because I only actually took stock of my life. You know, if I thought I was taking stock of my life in the last 15 years, well, boy, was I wrong, because I only took stock of it when COVID happened. That's what actually made me take stock of my life. And I think most people would agree with that.
Okay, what helped you form the thoughts and feelings that you came to during that period? Books,
being forced
music,
to. Being
art.
No, being
yes,
forced
but what
to.
Were the you just mentioned earlier that the big discovery for you is how you have been able to interpret your life and learn and gain from having the time to read novels. So whether it's books or music or whatever it is where people go ultimately when they are contemplating the bigger questions and when they're actually trying to find out about the truth of who they are, they go to art.
Well, I'm an artist. Of course, I found a way to continue to maintain being inspired and to adapt to a new reality. But if you think about someone who is a passive consumer of culture, which is, I don't know what percentage, but somewhere above 99, I'm guessing, then you really sort of understand that they're just going to, you know, sort of, if they passively consume culture, then they will only passively adapt to what their other cultural options are. And it just becomes a natural migration online that is very difficult to talk people out of, unless, as you propose, you go to more a model of actually creating community, which, of course, is a separate discussion from what's the business model going forward, because presumably creating community is not going to be anything comparable to the business model that we had before.
Let's talk about going forward, because you've done this show now. Do you have more planned? Would you do a tour like that? Like, how do you feel about the next 12 months of your life as an artist?
Yeah, I've booked things. I'm waiting to see on a case-by-case basis. There's different states in Germany that have different rules. I played a couple of small indoor shows for 150 people that was properly socially distanced, the kind that you would see a picture of on Twitter and someone would go, "That's so sad."
And how were they?
But I loved it. It was still fun. I made it work, and okay. It wasn't ideal, but I was happy to practice my craft. And I don't know, it reminded me of a lot of shows I did back in the day that were super awkward and weird and in strange places where,
yeah,
it wasn't ideal, but, you know, I had a lot of years of playing in not ideal situations.
Yeah, I mean, that's the joke, right? Every musician, their first 8 years of your career were socially distanced. You just didn't know it.
Exactly.
No one came to your shows.
So as I went to bed that night, I did two shows in one night because I was there. And I thought, well, a lot is now depending on my ability to offer two shows a night, because that enables, you know, the financial thing to be able to happen. And I'm up for doing that. I like the challenge, let's say. And I went to bed that night thinking, hey, if this is how it is for the next year or two, I'm talking about the indoor shows. If this is how it is for the next year or two, I can really live with that. And then of course I had my Cologne experience where I kind of was like, oh, it was like somehow 2019 came back, you know, and it was really, really, really intensely positive, as you can probably imagine. I'm sure you talked about your gig in the earlier part of the show, but can you give me a brief rundown?
Well, it's in contrast to what you're talking about. It's sort of all the more sad. You know, it was beautifully organized. The people who did it were great, and I admired their chutzpah, and everybody tried to be as spirited as they could, but the Ontario government wouldn't let anybody out of their cars. So it was pretty dystopian, I have to be honest, you know?
Right.
You'd finish a song and everyone would honk their horns and you'd automatically have like traffic anxiety. Like, I didn't ever think that would be an experience that I would have, is that somebody's emotional response to me playing a song would be for them to flash their headlights. But it's not the future. It can't, that's not going to work, you know? And I guess it goes back to the beginning of our argument or conversation, because I think we both agree in a way, but I am just simply saying that I don't think, maybe people don't know it right now And maybe it's not the time to make the argument in as strident a way as I'm making it, but I've lived my life. I've been raised and life has shown me over and over and over again that one of the most beautiful, joyful, fun human things that happen on this planet is when people get together and check something out, listen to music or hear a story. It is magical. It is beautiful. It's positive. It's the best of what people are. And I don't want to live in a world where we just seed that, where we just say, okay, we surrender. That part's gone now and we're never going back and we'll have Zoom shows and we'll have shows where people sit in cars and that's the new normal. I reject it. I outright reject that idea. There has to be a continued argument made for getting people together and telling them a story, be it in song, dance, or theater.
And, I respect what you reject, first of all. But I would just say, try to keep as much realism about to which degree that is true for everybody. Yeah. And that will in the end redound to all of our benefit.
Well, you know, you and I have known each other a long time now, and you know that realism has never been one of my fortes. I'll leave realism to Allie and you. And I will continue to live in my cloud cuckoo land and just to try and make the argument, you know? But God, I mean, one thing I hope is that next summer I'm seeing you on a stage in North America somewhere. That sure would make me happy. So,
well, likewise,
thank you.
I hope to see you around the corner at Luxor in Cologne, where I saw Stars last, and we'll have a nice hang afterwards, like we did back in whenever that was, 2015 or something.
And that would be wonderful.
Yeah. And Ali, I hope you get on stage and practice your craft too really soon. So I think we all know where this needs to go. And I really appreciate your extremism, Torquil. and I really, really think you guys are onto something with the Artistic New Deal. I would like to be able to help. I don't live in Canada, obviously, so my resources are limited to help, but I love the idea so much because I always thought, what's the connection between the obvious sort of corrupt grant giving system and education? How do you sort of break the logjam? And this is potentially an opportunity. We have all these essentially unemployed artists with this font of knowledge and love to bring. It would break the cycle of the myth of the flaneur artist, as you say, Torquil. It would reform the grant giving in so many ways, at least over a couple of generations. And it would bring Canada up to the level of what I've been privileged enough to experience by living in Europe. You're absolutely right. It's different over here. The general artistic literacy is huge.
And thank you so much for doing this with us again. And I hope you come back. Will you come back when you next are annoyed by something I say?
I'll keep listening. And when I can't stand the pressure anymore, I'm going to write to you.
Chilly Gonzalez there on Soft Revolution. So awesome to have him back. With his brilliant mind, and hear about what was happening in Europe and what it was like to actually play a show. I have to admit to some jealousy when he was recounting that moment. Feels like it's a long way out for us. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. But if you want to hear more of that interview with Gonzo, join our Patreon. For only $3 a month, you're going to get bonus pods, bonus interviews with all of our guests, Proust questionnaires with Chilly Gonzalez. I think he was the best Proust questionnaire answerer yet. No offense to our other guests.
It's like he was ready for it.
Yeah, it was like he trained for it. It was a real lightning round Proust questionnaire. And a great community of people. So please join us over on Patreon at Soft Revcast, on Instagram at Soft Revcast, and on the dreaded Twitter. I have to mention to you, Allie, that my life has changed for the better significantly over the last week because I installed a Google Chrome extension that allows me to block myself from websites. So no more
what?
New...
Yep. How's that work?
It just, when you click
on it... What do you mean block yourself?
When you try to go to it, they say, you don't want to go there.
And oh, you put like certain websites like Twitter.com and it's like, don't you dare, brah. Yeah,
Twitter, okay. New York Times, The Guardian, anything that has made me want to jump off a roof in the last 6 months. I'm getting my news strictly from the CBC at this point. So CBC, don't betray me by making me, don't make me ban you, CBC. Don't make me block myself. Just keep it on the bright side.
That's
Soft Revolution for another week. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week. We'll be resuming regular shows now, headed into this dreaded fall and long winter, and we'll see how we all get through it. I don't know, Ali. It's going to be a tough one. What's your art pick this week?
My pick is James Blake singing Frank Ocean's Godspeed. It's a song that they co-wrote together on Frank's album Blonde. It's one of the most beautiful songs. It's like a great song, not about falling in love, but letting go. And it is exquisitely sung. And that's my pick. What's yours?
Gee, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what my pick would be this week. And I think ultimately I've been here in my house in North Hatley, which is a little village in the hills. It doesn't have any heat. And I'm usually here with my family because it's a summer place, but I'm here in the fall and I'm alone and it's kind of weird and a little lonely. But I've been reading Emily Dickinson, the poet Emily Dickinson. And she grew up and lived in this part of the world, roughly speaking. She lived in New England. And it's a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. It has a kind of stillness to it and a humanness of scale. And people live fairly secretive lives here. You know, it's a kind of puritanical tradition here. And there's a lot of very beautiful gabled houses with small windows, and you can't really see into people's lives. And she had this incredible gift, a kind of time traveling level of forwardness and ahead of her timeness, and was able to reveal things about herself and about just being a person in these very strange, but very, very readable and very beautiful poems. So if you've never read Emily Dickinson, go get some. It'll make your life better. That's Soft Revolution for another week. We're going to hear James Blake on the way out singing Frank Ocean's song. And we're going to be back next week with hopefully some more hope. Hang in there. Make something. Promise me you'll make something this week. I'm going to try and make something.
Right.
You're going to make something, Ali?
I'm going to make a sandwich right now, baby. It's
going to
be amazing.
There you go. Go make a sandwich. Go make a sandwich, everybody. We love you. Stay safe. See you next week. Love you, man.
See ya.
How I do, I let go of a prayer for you. It's a sweet word, the table is prepared for you. Darkness of the mind.